I'm Tony Cox, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, Mexico's drug trafficking wars have claimed tens of thousands of lives, and with the recent massacre of 72 migrants from south of Mexico's borders, the violence is far from over. We'll talk about the dangerous but intricately organized Mexican drug cartels. But first, to one of the largest countries in the world, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It is the land of the mighty Congo River, which runs 3,000 miles and has fascinated explorers and kings alike. It has played a vital role, of course, in the lives of the Congolese. NPR's West Africa correspondent Ophabia Quist-Arkton took a long trip down the Congo River, providing rare insight into the relationship between the river and the people. She was joined on the trip by producer Jonathan Blakely, a first-timer to that part of the world. Both of them join us now, Ophabia from her office in Dakar, Senegal, and Jonathan from Baghdad, where he is on assignment. Hello to both of you.
Greetings.
Hi, Tony. Hi, Fabia.
Hi.
We cannot wait to hear more about this fascinating and remarkable trip that you took down the Congo. But before we get to that, Ophabia, I wanted to spend a couple of moments on a very significant piece of news coming out of the region, which is related to Congo's troubled history of civil war and violence, and a UN report about reprisal killings after the 1994 genocide. What's the latest there?
Now, the report is about what happened in Congo, but it really reflects on the army of Rwanda next door. As you know, the genocide in 1994, mainly Tutsi, 800,000 Tutsis killed there, and moderate Hutus. Now, what this leaked UN report, it has not been formally published yet, but what it is saying is that 2 years after, 1996 to 1997, these same Rwandan forces that were fighting the genocide across the border crossed into eastern Congo and apparently killed tens of thousands of Rwandan Hutu refugees and Congolese Hutu. Now, Rwanda is saying this report is rubbish, it's scurrilous, and it is actually threatening to pull out its peacekeeping forces from all UN operations, and it is actually commanding the joint UN-African Union peacekeeping force in Darfur, Sudan. So it's really very serious.
Is this saber-rattling by a Rwandan President Paul Kagame, or is he serious?
I think it's a bit of both. Up till now, really, Paul Kagame has had the lever on everyone because the international response to the genocide in Rwanda was so lackluster, in fact, virtually non-existent. He has had a lever on the United Nations, on Washington, which failed to respond under President Clinton, on Britain. In fact, all Western nations who Kagame blames for having done nothing during the genocide. Now his government, his foreign minister, Louise Mushikiwabo, is saying it's absolutely ludicrous and it's hypocritical and double standards of the UN to turn around and say that the same force that it allows to command its peacekeeping operations in Darfur is the force it is accusing of genocide, that the G word has been used, of atrocities in Congo, and that this is malicious.
We'll keep our eyes on that. Thank you very much, Ophabia. So now let's move on to this trip that you made, this fabulous trip with producer Jonathan Blakely, an exploration of the beauty and the people along the Congo River. You traveled 500 miles down the river on a barge. Here is a moment when you boarded the vessel.
Suddenly, this boat that we're taking is just chock-a-block. When I last visited it, there were, what, maybe a couple of dozen people on board and some goats. Now it looks as if there are 300 plus people on board and the vessel has considerably sunk. I hope we're within legal limits for how many people are allowed on board. Ma Flo. Bonjour. Good morning, Flo. How are you?
Ah, merci beaucoup.
On est prêt à partir? Are we ready to leave?
Oui, nous sommes prêts à partir.
Finally.
I'm going to ask you about the boat in just a moment, but what makes the Congo River such a fascinating body of water?
Tony, let me first tell you that it ain't a boat. It was not a boat. It was a barge. Two 50-foot barges lashed together and pushed
by a tugboat. Not a boat in the conventional sense of the word at all. But yeah, talking about the Congo River, it's quite something. It's massive. As you said, 3,000 odd miles. Most of it navigable, some of it not navigable. And it is the lifeline of the Congo. It runs through the heart of the country. It takes people into the interior, the remote hinterland, where, you know, we were passing villages that were literally made up of one or two mud huts, slightly bigger villages, towns, but they all relied on the river. As one Congolese balladeer sang, this river is our main boulevard. It is the artery of Congo.
Jonathan Blakely, let me bring you into the conversation. I'm curious to hear from you what your thoughts were when you first, A, saw the Congo River itself and all its majesty, and B, when you saw that barge that was going to be your home for a while.
Yeah, you look at that barge and you say, you mean that one right there, the one with all the people on it? I don't think there's any room for us. But we did figure out a way to get on that barge thanks to our guide and journalist and interpreter, Emery Makumeno. And he wheeled and dealed and got us onto that barge. But I'm just now getting to absorb how magnificent and what a wonderful and amazing journey I took with Ophabia. It was so overwhelming. There's so much coming at you, not just the people, but the beauty of that part of the world, a part of the world that, you know, most people never get to see with their own eyes. I got to see 500 miles of it on that river.
If you're just joining us, I'm Tony Cox, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with NPR's West Africa correspondent, Ophabia Quist-Arkton, about Africa's third largest country, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and her recent trip to the mighty Congo River, along with NPR producer Jonathan Blakely. Before I ask you the next question, Ophabia, about it, let's listen to another part of your report about some of the food on the barge.
I see a monkey.
Oh, maybe the viande aussi, the sand.
Martin Kapanga is clutching a smoked monkey, considered a mouth-watering delicacy in many parts of Congo, while he points to a range of other live animals on board. Some are pets. Others will end up in cooking pots. Kapanga has invited us to tuck into what he promises will be a delicious smoked monkey stew.
I don't know if you know this, Ophabia, or not, but there was quite a reaction to that part of your report on the NPR website, people talking about, you know, eating monkeys, and some had, well, positive things to say, and some had some more curious kinds of things to say. Tell us more about that experience.
Well, yes, we have to, you know, there are some things Americans eat that people in the rest of the world also look askance at, but I have to say that monkeys and other bushmeat, as they're called, are delicacies in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Congolese enjoy it. It's true that in the West there's much more education about conservation, about animals, but we're not talking about the great apes here. We're not talking about our brothers and sisters, the baboons, and so on. We're talking about monkey meat, and they do eat it. And what's more, they eat it and enjoy it. So I think some people have been a bit offended. They felt that perhaps I should have said to the Congolese, no, you should think about conservation. But people are surviving in Congo. You know, they don't sometimes have the option, and they don't have the sort of money and in the West to decide whether or not and what they're going to eat. Fresh fish from the Congo River was what they mostly ate, but they also brought smoked fish, salted fish, and smoked monkey because they could preserve that and eat it on the way. I wasn't there to judge. I was there to observe with Jonathan life on the Congo River, and that's what we observed.
So Jonathan, what did it taste like? Chicken?
I respectfully declined.
You didn't try it, huh? You were
no. I it was just the camera that got close to that monkey, not my palate.
Not you. You weren't quite ready for that. Let me ask the both of you to describe in more detail for us about the people on the barge. How many people were there? And from your reports, I got the impression that it wasn't just a barge for transporting people from one place to another, but the barge had life of its own on the barge. Ophabia?
I'll take the first answer. Yes, a life of its own, a rhythm of its own. We went quite slowly. People were quite frustrated on that barge. But we met everybody. We met a judo instructor who was trying to get to Kinshasa because he had to take his judo team. Was it to South Korea, Jonathan? Something like that.
I believe it was South Korea, exactly.
We had many, many traders, people who were trading in palm oil for cooking. We had people who were trading in all sorts. The boat was full. It was full of live animals. We had these head-butting goats who weren't very far from us on our place on the deck. I mean, there were lambs, there were chickens. Some were pets, but many were being taken down to the capital, Kinshasa, to be sold. So there was a lot of trade going on the boat. And of course, a lot of villagers coming in their dugout canoes, poling and paddling these canoes, sliding up against the barge, and then selling what we ate every day, plantains, cassava, fruit, the most delicious mangoes, papaya. And what else did we have, Jonathan? Oh, pineapples. I mean, fresh fish.
Yeah, if you remember, Ophabia, you cooked this, I will call it Ophabia's brew when I caught a bit of a cold. But all the material for that brew, the lemons and the honey, the only thing we brought tea, but everything that you could want for Ophabia's brew, which did make me feel better, by the way, was available from these dugout canoes that, as if on cue, at 7 in the morning, as we're steaming along down the Congo River, from the villages, these dugout canoes and people in them with all their goods just come straight for us, and haggling time begins. It's fascinating.
Let me ask you, Jonathan, because you are in Baghdad and the danger there is palpable. Did you have a sense of danger while you were on the barge going down the Congo River?
Well, you hear of barges in situations like these, not just in Central Africa, but other parts of Africa and other parts of the world, that will overturn. So I was concerned about that, especially when you heard Ophabia's report. And there was, at one point, you felt the barge kind of lunge downward. It's like, okay, that's not good. And then our first night, we were introduced to the elements via a terrible rainstorm, which you don't want to be inside a boat like that with that type of rain. This is the first time I've been in a boat with rain, and the boat was really moving about. Well, we were saved. There was one of two bad rainstorms, but we had a wonderful captain who said, I think, Ophabia, he could navigate the Congo River blindfolded or at night. They wouldn't let them go at night because for safety reasons. And the fact that when you go down the river, there's a big problem with sand barges. And that's what usually causes these barges to overturn. Matter of fact, I think after we finished our reports and we're putting them together, a barge did overturn and some people did lose their lives on the Congo River.
Well, you know, Ophabia, you mentioned also that there was a threat from Congolese rebels if you are on one of these barges, and security personnel have been added to make things safer. Before I ask you a question, let's listen to one more clip from your series.
Another daily ritual, security and immigration checkpoints, and even megaphone instructions. Security along the Congo River has been tightened in recent months because of unrest by rebels upriver. To comply with the new regulations means jumping into a dugout canoe and getting to shore to have travel documents checked. Most times it was just us, the journalists, singled out. But on a couple of occasions, all the passengers were ordered to leave the barge.
Now, Jonathan says that he was a little concerned about that boat, but my question for you, Ophabia, is whether or not there was more concern about the rebels and the potential for a rebel attack than the dangers of the barge itself.
You know, that's what we were told, Tony, and we were actually forbidden from going upriver because we had thought that maybe we'd go from Mbandaka up to Kisangani where the Stanley Falls are. We were told no because there had been some rebel activity. But, you know, once we were on the barge, I didn't feel at all unsafe, and I didn't think any rebels were going to sneak up and suddenly try and abduct us. No, I was much, much more fascinated by the creativity, the ingenious creativity of the Congolese living on these barges, or these lashed together barges, on this huge barge, 300 plus of us with all these animals, and living as if they were almost living on land, except that we were on water. It was literally a floating supermarket, a floating market, a floating village. People were carrying on, very organized, doing their cooking, doing their washing, using the river for everything, for cooking, for drinking, for bathing. The Congo River is second to none. It was absolutely extraordinary, Tony. And I advise everybody to take your courage, because it does need a little bit of courage,
to do it, huh?
And to travel down the Congo River. It was really an experience and discovery and adventure all the way.
Our time has run out. This has been a fascinating story to hear about. Jonathan Blakely, I'm going to give you the last word, because I understand that as an African-American, which you are, that you were seen on the trip as something other than that. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, and I think that became quite apparent when I decided, when we had one of our stops at one of the villages, I decided, with among most people on the boat, to take a bath in the Congo River. So me with my orange shorts and my two-toned sunburnt skin, I kind of stood out from everyone. And I was called by kids, Mundele, Mundele, Mundele. So it didn't take much to realize that they were calling me white man. But it's funny, because that's just at that time, Ophabia, who was taking pictures, came by on a canoe and said, "You realize, is Obama black?" And they said, "Yeah, well, Jonathan's black too." And they were just dumbfounded. They knew, they had no idea what to say.
A remarkable story. Ophabia Quist-Arkton is NPR's West Africa correspondent, joining us from Dakar, Senegal. Jonathan Blakely is an NPR producer, joining us from Baghdad to hear their five-part series on the Congo River and see pictures from this remarkable trip. Just go to our website at npr.org. Ophabia, Jonathan, good job. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
You're welcome.